Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. For decades, I've been preaching about the importance of a regimen of basic supplements that everyone should consider part of their daily health routine. So I came up with an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle. The very same supplements I take myself and prescribe for my patients. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com and check out my Intelligent Medicine Starter Kit. It's a short list of the basic supplements that I recommend as a starting point for those looking to take control of their health. They're the essential elements of a basic program that everyone could benefit from. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about a great new book. It's Doing Harm, and it's about the gulf that still exists in medical treatment for men versus women, and how women get the short end of the stick, so to speak, sometimes when their complaints are dismissed, when medical science is not making sufficient advances to address their health concerns. That's what this book is all about. There are many instances of this. Maya, what is happening, however, and this began to happen when I was in medical school. There was a revolution in the enrollment in terms of the sex differences. Our class set a record. We had fully one-third of our class in medical school at Albert Einstein College of Medicine that were women. That was considered very progressive in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the ratio is more than 50%. I think more these days in many schools, it's more than 50% of the enrollees are women. That's likely to make some differences, but I'm concerned that, you know, if you just put a woman in the place of a man, say in the field of OBGYN or in pediatrics, yeah, we're going to bring a woman's sensibilities and a woman's intuition to play. But if we're still part of a paternalistic medical system, those women may act like the worst male drill sergeants, you know, when it comes to treating their patients. I really do have a concern about that.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you. I do think that there is evidence that women as researchers tend to do more research on women's health issues or gender disparities. There's definitely a lot of research that shows that women in general tend to be more patient-centered doctors.
More empathetic, you know, I think that's something to that. It really is, I think.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's definitely reasons to, you know, beyond just belief in fairness and gender equality to be heartened by the fact that more women are going into the medical profession. But I do agree that we should definitely not assume that will be enough to really fix these very, very long-standing and at this point very entrenched problems that really I think are about so much about systemic bias in medical knowledge itself. So a female physician is going through the same medical training as a male one and learning the same medical knowledge base that has been skewed towards just knowing more about the male body and conditions that affect men. And I think it's also so much about these really unconscious implicit biases that really do affect all of us, male or female, in the profession or not. And so I think it will definitely take more of a kind of proactive, concerted effort to really fix these problems and recognize exactly how they're operating on a systemic level and really just are not about individuals, you know, being consciously sexist in the least. And I think, you know, that in one way that makes it harder to fix, but I think it also is an opening to kind of urge the profession to realize, you know, this is not about blaming individuals. This is about kind of looking at where these gaps are, where there are these clear disparities and how to shift how we work to remedy them.
Indeed. So you have a section in the book entitled The Diseases Formerly Known as Hysteria. It makes me think of the artist formerly known as Prince,
yeah.
You know, but and maybe consciously you formulated the sentence that way, but there's a whole raft of diseases that once came under the rubric of, you know, just sort of the fevered imaginings of the female brain, which now have come into their own as medical diagnoses. Can you talk about some of them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in some ways, so many conditions that disproportionately affect women could fall in that category, you know, from, you know, multiple sclerosis was differentiated from hysteria way back when, and various autoimmune diseases would have fallen into that category probably before they were recognized. But in the book, I especially talk about what are sometimes called contested illnesses like fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivity, chronic Lyme. And all of these have sometimes been called fashionable illnesses, which I think is another very gendered term for them.
It's very patronizing, you know. It's dismissive.
Yes, very dismissive, and I think, you know, implicitly and often explicitly, part of the argument that skeptics of these conditions have made is that, you know, well, they disproportionately affect women, therefore it's unlikely that they're, you know, real. They're likely just the age old kind of hysterical tendencies of women.
That's kind of circular reasoning, right?
It is. It's maddeningly circular reasoning. And it really has kept these conditions in this catch 22 where, because of that assumption that they're psychosomatic until proven otherwise, the medical community has not invested in the research that would prove otherwise, that would show what the underlying biology is. And so I think that, you know, helps explain why something like fibromyalgia, which affects millions of mostly female patients and causes great disability and suffering, gets just astoundingly little research funding. And of course, among many is belittled as a made up, you know, fabricated disease. I think that's a dynamic that I think you can kind of point to throughout medical history that has really kind of held back the progress that we could have been making if we had really been taking women's complaints seriously and just assuming that their own testimony about what they were feeling in their body was evidence of a real disease. You know, all of these conditions, I think we would know much more about.
And what many of them have in common is that there's an autoimmune component. And in the book, you state that the estimate is that 50 million women suffer from autoimmune disease. The population of the United States is, you know, adult population, you know, probably under 300 million. So we're talking about one third of the female population of adult women suffer from some form of autoimmunity. What's up with that? Why is there such an epidemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is the question that really got me started down this path because I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, 5 years ago. And as I became more interested in autoimmune diseases, it seemed striking to me that so many people were affected. And yet, you know, you don't hear a lot about autoimmune diseases in the public. And so many patients report having these really long diagnostic delays, and during that time, really feeling like they're dismissed as chronic complainers. So the book is started. Yeah,
I'll give you an instance. Is my mother came down with rheumatoid arthritis, and she was diagnosed as simply having a bad menopause. They just said, well, you know, you've got empty nest syndrome, and you know, your hormones are off. They didn't want to give her hormones, of course, because that was considered dangerous. But you know, it was just attributed to, well, that's just sort of a middle-aged women have lots of aches and pains, and you know, that's sort of the way it is. And then her joints started to swell and become deformed, and okay, well now she graduated to a full-blown diagnosis, but it took you know. As you say, there was a diagnostic delay of 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. And I mean, I was very lucky in that I was diagnosed quickly, but according to a study in the last few years, it takes an average of 4 years and patients see four doctors during that time. And I think it's a great illustration of how I think this problem is somewhat self-perpetuating because one of the things that I really learned from talking to experts in diagnostic error is that one of the key problems is that doctors are not often getting feedback on their errors. Since we don't have really good systematic feedback mechanisms, they really kind of assume that they got it right unless they hear otherwise. So to take the example of an autoimmune patient, if she goes to four doctors or three doctors and then is diagnosed finally by a fourth doctor, those first three doctors who maybe determined that she was just stressed or going through menopause, they often don't get the memo about that diagnosis. And that sort of leaves them with this impression that their offices are filled with lots of young and middle-aged women complaining of fatigue and other subjective symptoms. And as long as they kind of don't realize what the ultimate diagnosis was, that kind of perpetuates the stereotype that women are prone to symptoms that are all in their head.
And I think that there's a psychological mechanism on the part of doctors that if they don't have tools at their disposal to treat a condition, you know, say a patient has fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome, that because there's not a prescription that they can push across the table, that they may assign it into the mental category by default. And it's really hard for doctors to say, look, I know you have this condition. We don't really know what to do for it. I'm really sorry, but I believe you. It's easier to say, you know, I don't know what you have. All your tests are negative. Come back when you actually have a positive blood test for rheumatoid arthritis or for lupus or for something tangible. Then we can put you on immunosuppressive therapy because that's the way the algorithm works is, you know, test result, write a prescription.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. And it's so unfortunate because I think from the patient perspective, it feels like seems so little to just offer that kind of validation and that kind of honesty about, yeah, I don't know what's going on with you, but I believe that something's going on and either I don't know personally what the diagnosis is or maybe, you know, medical knowledge itself, we don't yet understand what's going on with you. But that kind of validation can just go so far. And yet it's true that so many doctors seem to not be able to offer that. And also I think we should acknowledge that there are so many disincentives to kind of doing that. You know, there are time constraints, there's a kind of financial incentive to really kind of get patients that you can't really help out of your office and onto somebody else. And, yeah.
And I will say that, you know, from my perspective, I'm a practitioner of complementary medicine, and I think that this is actually one of the reasons why our offices are so populated with women. Overwhelmingly, the majority of our patients are women, and not to the exclusion of men, because men have problems too that aren't addressed by conventional medicine. But so many women have conditions like Hashimoto's thyroiditis, POTS, postural orthostatic hypotension, chronic migraines, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and on it goes. Chronic Lyme disease, you actually cite as a condition that many women suffer from, and yet that's a condition it's actually debated whether it even exists. You know, that once you get your antibiotics and you're not feeling well, I don't know, maybe you're just down in the dumps. What else is going on in your life? Talk to a therapist, get some Lexapro.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's totally true. I'm actually been working on an article that talks more specifically about that, how so many women, I think, turn to alternative practices because they're being failed so much by what mainstream medicine is offering them. And I, as a journalist, it kind of drives me crazy how alternative and complementary health is really kind of discussed and dismissed and in, I think, very sexist ways, without that acknowledgement that I think a lot of patients are turning to alternatives just because they don't have, they're not because they're necessarily alternatives, but because they really just are left without any options from mainstream medicine. And I certainly feel really lucky that I was, I started doing nutritional approaches to my RA very quickly. And I think that they were really helpful. And I do definitely agree that is one of the reasons you find so many women turning to those kind of things.
Well, there is a bit of a misogynistic flavor to some of the attacks on alternative medicine, you know, disparaging, you know, certain practices as woo-woo and, you know, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, all that stuff is that it's not rational. It doesn't have the hard edge of data-driven scientifically validated empiric fact. And yet, you know, that it is a paternalistic medical system. It's a medical system that's based on, quote, hard science. And yet, you know, harken back to the role of healers in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, if you got sick, you had the option of going to a physician who would likely kill you. Or, you know, male doctor who would bleed you or put cups on you or maybe give you a cathartic or something. And, you know, you would die miserably, of, you know, of the treatment. Or you could go to, and this is these were women who were sometimes hunted down as witches because they were mm-hmm. practicing sorcery. They were going to the woods and gathering herbs and poultices. And they actually, for many centuries, were the repositories of true healing because they got it about the subtle processes of the body that didn't respond to these heroic measures that were, you know, so male in a way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think learning that history, which I think I sort of vaguely knew, but certainly not in as much depth, and really realizing that that sort of male takeover of the profession, in the US at least, really happened so much earlier than those practices had any basis in science. You know, healing became this for-profit, male-dominated profession long before it had any relationship to science. And in the meantime, yes, all of these mostly female healers who really had centuries of wisdom based on observation and actually working with patients, all of them were really aggressively kind of pushed out of the profession in order for that takeover to happen.
Let's also look at the area of women's sexuality. You know, when it comes to male enhancement, erectile dysfunction, now, you know, a bona fide medical condition. Men are winning the arms race when it comes to enhancement of sexual performance. Women are lagging woefully behind. Is that a result of some inherent bias, or is it just simply tinkering with the female libido is a little dicier than just using Viagra to promote circulation to a certain part of your body?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. I wrote an article a few years ago when the so-called female Viagra pill was approved by the FDA.
By the way, a real flop. I forget what it was called, but side effects include fainting. That's really romantic, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the female Viagra was a misnomer, of course, because it's not at all like Viagra. And in fact, is a drug you have to take every day and had many side effects and was rejected twice by the FDA before it was finally approved. But it was an interesting sort of episode where the drug sponsor was able to get some feminist organizations on board by making that argument that, you know, women were losing the race here, and that it was a kind of a issue of gender equality to give them something. And then you had, you know, I think, other feminist groups who I think were in the right on this one saying, well, okay, but this particular drug, I think, isn't great.
Yeah, it seems like a win, but like, be careful what you wish for, because...
Yeah. Right. And also, I think, raised some interesting questions about, you know, how... To what extent can you kind of treat low libido with a drug without kind of considering the social context,
right,
and the way that some, at least to some extent, women's sexual difficulties may be more related to relationship problems or
cultural
stress
issues,
or cultural things that aren't going to be solved by big pharma, but. Yeah, it was an interesting episode that I think revealed a lot of the tensions there and the ways that medicine wasn't taking women, certainly not taking women's sexual problems seriously, but also maybe not taking their side effects to a pretty bad drug seriously either.
Yeah, another big problem is the frequency of C-sections. There's some real... over-exuberance when it comes to those kind of procedures with women. And, they're trying to curtail that, but it seems like such an inculcated practice. We're really not doing that well in the field of women's birthing practices here in this country.
Yeah. I mean, and this is something that I didn't get too much into in the book, but I've been following a lot of the recent coverage that maternal mortality rate in the U.S. has been getting lately, that I think has been really, really wonderful and really key in kind of pointing out, first of all, the huge racial disparities that exist, where in this country, Black women are four times more likely than white women to die in childbirth. And I think a lot of this coverage has really highlighted the fact that a lot of these deaths are preventable, and are due to not only things like unnecessary interventions like C-sections, but also just, again, what we've been talking about, just not listening to women and dismissing them. And, you know, you hearing horrible stories of women who, knew that something was wrong in childbirth or in the postpartum period and were kind of just dismissed. And I think the experience of Serena Williams was really illustrative recently, where she had a complication afterwards. And, you know, even she is this world-class athlete, woman was initially told by the nurse, oh, you know, it's fine.
It's not a merit system. It wasn't as if she was a drug addicted, inner city person, bad diet. And so none of that.
Nope. And yeah, and she really had to fight to get them to take her seriously.
So bottom line, what can be done? What are some additional resources for people? And if you're a woman, I mean, how can you become more conscious so you can avoid some of the pitfalls inherent in our medical system?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a challenging question for me, because I think that to some extent, I feel like the burden should not be on individuals to kind of try to fix these problems or to compensate for the failures of the system. But I do hope that just by being kind of armed with some of the history and the context that's included in the book, that will empower women to feel comfortable pushing back if they're if they're dismissed and seeking out a second opinion or a third or a fourth or a fifth. Because one of the things I was actually very, very surprised by to some extent was that so many women, even if they're very educated and kind of have a lot of authority in the rest of their lives, really spoke to this reality that when you are hearing from a medical expert, you know, who has a degree and a white coat, and they're saying nothing's wrong, it's just stress or something, it is very, very difficult to kind of trust yourself instead of in them and push back. And so I hope that just by realizing that it's not just you, you know, that these experiences are reflective of these larger systemic problems in the system, that will help women feel a little bit more empowered to do that. But again, more broadly, I think that this is a problem that those within the profession need to step up to the plate to fix, and really can't be fixed by individuals, because they are so much deeper than that, and really about how we do clinical research and how we educate the next generation of doctors, and how we get feedback systems in place so that doctors are learning from their errors, and all of these really big systemic problems that really require the will of those who are in charge of these systems.
And the message for women, though, is trust your instincts, listen to your inner voice, because women, I think, are especially equipped to be attuned to their bodies in so many more ways than men. Men, in many ways, are, unfortunately, I mean, to their detriment, are oblivious to their bodies. Women are more attuned. That may cause more distress, but pay attention to the distress signals, because they may be indicative of a looming problem, and you know, begin to address the problem before it emerges into a major calamitous disease state. I think that's an important message to get across to women. Thank you very much for joining us. The book is Doing Harm, Maya Dusenberry, the author, and she's also, your website is feministing.com, where you'll find more information.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate you joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.